words from our epistle this morning. For God did not give us a spirit of cowardice, but a spirit of power and love and self-control. It's very good to be with you here. I first visited Canada around 15 years ago, in the middle of some testing times for your province of the church. And there have been testing times since, as you know only too well. But the Anglican Church of Canada is a part of the Anglican Communion that I've always admired for showing the best of Christian virtues, the best of Anglican virtues. And among the best of Anglican virtues is that we have our rows in public. There are parts of Christ's Church Universal that pretend that there's no possibility of having total disagreements on matters of faith and still stay part of the same church. That's not the Anglican way, and I rejoice in that fact. Ours is not a comfortable way to live out the Christian life, but it's honest. And along with the writer of the Epistle to Timothy, we look to a God who did not give his church a spirit of cowardice, but a whole load of other gifts of the Spirit, some of which he names, some of which he doesn't. The gifts he does name are power, love, self-control. And they amount to the gifts that divided Christians need for coping with conflict. And the reverse of cowardice involves courage and thoughtfulness. Conflict can be misunderstood. It may involve pain and may bring scandal. But it is as much a sign of health as of sickness. In human life, conflict happens when change happens. All mums and dads will know this from the years when their children grew up. Children cannot remain children. They mature. They become grown-ups, adults. And the experience is often painful for both parents and children. But that growth needs to happen. And for Christians, built into the very foundation doctrines of the Christian faith are huge claims which in human logic might seem to be in conflict. God is made human. The Lord of all power and might is born helpless in a stable and dies helpless, nailed to a gallows. Now, the simple effort to understand these cornerstones of Christian faith sends us furiously arguing as to what they might mean. And that's before we start arguing about the far more trivial rows that have troubled the church in the last few decades. If you think the church is faced with difficult times now, then you should look back to some of the earliest fights in its history. And those fights are there in the letters bearing the name of the Apostle Paul. You will find conflict, even in those brand new churches of believers. Now, our reading from the Epistle from 2 Timothy stopped just in time before we heard the writer launch into, frankly, an angry rant. Read on from what we heard, and you will find out. You are aware that all who are in Asia turned away from me, Paul complains. And then he names names. We don't actually hear about what that particular row was about. But indeed, you can start reading about any period in Christian history, and the rows, the arguments, sound as loud in the past as in the present. It can get you down. I remember one session as a young scholar in my first job in a theological college where I was teaching about some depressing and intricate set of rows in the early church. And one poor, simple student asked in despair, "Where is the good news in all this?" Well, I told him the good news is that the church is still there after nearly 2,000 years. Still, this is not a recipe for sitting back and nodding wisely when a fight erupts in the church, whatever it might be, and you will know what yours are. Conflicts must be dealt with in a grown-up way, and we must find ways of sorting them which produce real maturity, real grown-upness. We're not tabloid newspaper editors. We should not think in headlines. We're called to what you might describe as thoughtful holiness. And we are called to discipline. Now, discipline is not a fashionable word, I know. And it can conjure up the wrong image. Short, sharp shocks was a phrase that we had in the United Kingdom about 20 years ago, among politicians, that is. Discipline is a much richer word than that image implies. It's built into our identity as Anglicans because in the DNA of our church is a system of discipline, government by bishops. And that's meant very different things in the course of the church's history. Nowadays, a bishop's government is balanced by the decisions of the whole people of the church around him or her. Now, that's not so much a new development as a very old one. It's like the story of the very early church, as far as we can recover it. So Anglicans have a discipline, and we need to think about what that discipline is. Christians are people under discipline because it comes from outside ourselves. Our faith lies in the God who has created us. And Christian discipline will be shaped by its starting point. God made human in Jesus Christ. Word became flesh, in our Christian technical language, the incarnation. The incarnation, Word made flesh, is an expression of love. The Christian life is founded, therefore, on love. If love is the basis of the way in which Christians live, this has an important consequence for Christian discipline. Because love cannot be an unchanging set of rules. Systems which are built out of pure neutral patterns can only operate on a system of unalterable rules. So, make one mistake at the computer keyboard and the laptop won't let you into its system. Connect the wrong wires on a plug and you're in trouble. But Christian discipline is not of that character. Because the Christian faith maintains that creation is more than a pure, neutral pattern. It is grounded on the love of God. You might have heard of a great medieval work of devotion by St. Thomas a Kempis. It's called The Imitation of Christ. Imitation of Christ. We are called to imitate Jesus of Nazareth as best we can, and the best is never going to be very good. But we have to go on trying. Now, surely, you might say, Jesus Christ is the same always, so the imitation of Christ is not going to change from generation to generation. No, that's a misreading of imitation. You imitate the Mona Lisa by setting up your easel in front of the portrait, not that you're allowed to do that now, and then, with your easel, you paint as good a copy of it as you can. That's a sort of imitation. And the goodness of the copy is judged by how little different it is from the original. But the Mona Lisa is static, frozen at the moment when Leonardo da Vinci painted it. And it's decaying away from that moment, despite all the efforts of the conservationists in the Louvre in Paris. Jesus Christ is not like that, frozen in the first century of the Common Era. It's the Catholic doctrine of the Church to affirm that he is alive and that he is, in his humanity, part of every generation, changing from age to age because he is amid an infinite variety of human experiences. To imitate Jesus Christ will be to find out what the contemporary age, our age, is like, and how love is best expressed in it. Christ is our contemporary. He's not there in the past. Now, this is a complex, challenging business, more complex than obeying a set of ancient rules. It requires this discipline of what I've called thoughtful holiness, or it will end in shipwreck. We may have to accept that this sort of discipline may be radically different from disciplines which can be labeled Christian in other centuries. And that should not cause us distress or make us condemn one discipline of another age in the terms set by ours. Let me try out on you one possible way to understand how this works. And the discipline is the discipline of music. You might think of other parallels, but music means a great deal to me, and I hope you'll bear with me. In music, as the choir knows, there are patterns greater than human understanding or effort. There's a story about a great English scholar bishop called Charles Gore, and he came out of the concert hall after listening to one of Bach's Brandenburg Concerti, and he growled with a gruffness typical of the man, "If that is true, everything must be all right." Now, the point about the discipline of music is that it is strict within its own terms, but infinite in its variety over time. The delight of Bach's Brandenburg Concerti is that they are completely true to their own rules of harmony, rhythm, structure, and they play with those rules in a wonderful freedom because their composer knows the rules so well. But Bach's rules are not the same as those to which Monteverdi wrote his Vespers in Renaissance Venice, still more remote from those that medieval mystic Hildegard of Bingen used in her holy songs. They differ again from the rules used by successor composers in our own age. But we wouldn't dream of criticizing a modern composer for not obeying the rules of J.S. Bach. We can look at all these works in perspective, and we can understand the principles on which they're constructed. And still, we can view all these varieties of the musical discipline as related to each other. Each composer is writing within a musical tradition, that of the West. In the case of music, the passage of time has altered the tradition, but the tradition grows organically as the same body, just as a human body does in a single human lifetime. It's a galaxy of individual human decisions working within the Western tradition of music, each time testing it out, extending it, transforming it. And the one certainty about the discipline of music is that it is always in a state of moving on. Each musical composition is changing the shape of the discipline. But the change does nothing to undermine the beauty of a Brandenburg concerto within its own terms, or lessen the possibility of delight in it. And discipline does not cease to be discipline simply because it is not that of a previous age. So it seems to me that Christian discipline is like musical discipline. The Catholic tradition in which the Anglican Communion stands is like the tradition of music, not like the rule book of some technical process. And its guiding principle is the love of God, which is always one and the same, yet is always changing in the experience of human beings. Now that will raise another problem for us. How do you guard a tradition which is always changing? Or to put it the other way around, how does authority in our time, our Anglican Communion, move to change a matter of discipline and doctrine which affects the whole church? Well, the easy answer is that you wait and see. You wait for a new set of agreements to come together. And that's how you might characterize the moves to the ordination of women to the priesthood in the Anglican Communion, then our ongoing strivings towards equal marriage. Throughout all this process, there has been much pain and anger, and perhaps not a little what in England we'd call fudging about rules and hard cases. I'm afraid I have to admit that fudging is an uncomfortably frequent Anglican response to painful dilemmas. But out of this pain of decisions, a new pattern is slowly coming into sight. That doesn't lessen the pain. It doesn't make forgiving the pain any easier for the victims. But a new pattern is the end of the process of change, not the beginning. How does it start? Almost by definition, not with the acclaiming shout of the crowd, but with a lonely pioneer, the nonconformist voice. How then do the guardians of tradition, the bishops, the synod, distinguish between those who are the creative extenders of tradition and those who are the irresponsible wreckers of it? How does the leader interpret the enthusiasm of the prophet to those who find the prophecy bewildering? Church leaders in all ages have this question, and they have to remember the Roman Catholic Church condemning Galileo in 1633. That wasn't the right answer, and in fact, Pope John Paul II apologized for it some two decades ago. But back to Bishop Charles Gore. There's a phrase at the end of one of his books which is worth remembering. That phrase is, "Oh, yet consider it again." I think there's a wonderful ambiguity about that, "Oh, yet consider it again." Is it a conservative shout, or is it a shout of innovation? Consider it again. Consider your defiant reassertion of old certainty, or consider your confident assertion of destructive novelty. Which is it? It's the motto of thoughtful holiness. Think of that word, thoughtfulness. And one meaning of that word is attention. Sometimes when we say someone is thoughtful, we mean they're miles away. But there's also an everyday meaning, human meaning of thoughtfulness, consideration for the needs and wants of other people. Its opposite, thoughtlessness, is heedlessness, failure to pay attention. And when we call someone a really thoughtful person, we mean that this is someone who characteristically takes the trouble to consider how things are for us. So to attend the consequences of our actions, still more important, to attend to each other, that's the best way to resolve the tension we feel, need to feel, between traditionalism and radicalism. Oh, yet consider it again. Attending to what is really going on, trying to see the point of other people's concerns, what they mind about and why. That's a way of developing sensitive understanding on which we can act responsibly. Thoughtfulness is noticing and taking time and bothering. Such attentiveness doesn't come naturally to some of us. It's easier to be heedless. Paying attention is a discipline, and it's also the discipline we need most. In the words of our epistle to Timothy, it is the spirit of power and love and self-control. May we pray to our Father in heaven to lead us into the presence of such a spirit. Amen.